is the Aston Martin Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Aston Martin Heritage Trust Podcast. I am Gary Taylor and today we are at Acuri Bitelli. It's the 4th of July and it's their 50 years. And next to me is Steve Waddenham, AML historian and trustee. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Gary. Good to see you.
And you. It's a lovely day here. We've got a cracking collection of cars to celebrate EB's 50 years, haven't we?
Yeah, it's amazing, really. I mean, it's obviously a celebration of a business, but, you know, a very important business to Aston Martin history. Without the efforts of Acuri Bitelli over the last 50 years, I don't think we'd have as many cars to look at and to celebrate as we have. So pretty incredible, really.
It is quite incredible. The pre-war Astons, they have they're always active. I mean, I know Tom Wood through the Aston Martin Owners Club. He has a very active group there, and you get their monthly newsletter, and the pre-war community is very active, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, it's bucking the trend, really. A lot of things you read about pre-war cars in general nowadays are fairly negative about values of cars coming down. But we're seeing the opposite with Aston Martin, really. We're seeing a growth of lots of new, younger people buying the cars. Quite often, people who actually own a modern Aston Martin that are interested in the history. And you discover this entirely different sort of world, if you like. And there's a real skill involved. If you own a pre-war Aston Martin, there's two ways of doing it. You can either try and maintain it yourself, and if you want to do that, there's plenty of support to do that. Or you can get these guys to look after it for you mechanically. Bodywork's not really an issue on these sort of cars. They don't corrode like...
And mechanically relatively simple, and it can be remade, can't it?
Absolutely. Nothing electronic to worry about. So, but the big thing is learning how to drive them. You know, and I always say it's a bit like if you were going to learn to fly a microlight or fly a helicopter, you would have to kind of learn to control that vehicle. And a little bit similar to an Aston Martin, a pre-war car, there's different skills involved.
Now, here we are. Just like somebody's just walked outside number 10. Down is we have Robert Blakemore. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
And you are?
Andy Bell.
Andy Bell. Hello. This must be a big moment for you both, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really special.
Andy Bell, what's your background?
My background is owning and running Acuri Bitelli for 35 years.
Yeah. And you're still here and you're still enjoying it?
Prior to that, I was at Mountain for 10 years.
I remember that. I remember coming here in the AMOC days with Derek Edwards, yes. I think.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to go out in an Ulster or something like that, and I saw a rather nice 1598, which I took a shine to.
Yeah, Derek was key figure in the history of this company. The key figure, really, I suppose. Because without Derek, Nick wouldn't have been involved and Mountain wouldn't have started in Kentish Town and it wouldn't have morphed into Acuri Bitelli. So Derek was the kingpin.
Yeah. Why the change of name? What happened there? What's the background behind that?
Well, Mountain went bust when Middlebridge took it over. It conked out. Derek and Judy were sacked from Mountain for allegedly financial malpractice. They opened an account so that they could pay their creditors. And Dennis Nursey at Middlebridge didn't like that, so he fired them both. And shortly after that, it just fizzled out. And Derek started Acuri Bitelli with another backer. And 6 weeks after that, we bought out the remains of Mountain Engineering. So there was it was a slippery route, but that was what happened.
Yeah.
And 6 weeks after that, we moved to Oni here.
Yes.
And Acuri Bitelli put up this building for Acuri Bitelli, which is why it's got the showroom, and the cars neatly are 3x3 in the showroom. And not long after that, I bought the company out and ran it until Robert came along. 25 years later, 30 years later.
My father bought a car from Mountain in Kentish Town. So I grew up with pre-war Astons and coming here when I was a teenager, seeing the cars and seeing Andy race and my dad and Nick and other people and Derek. So I knew Derek. Was very fortunate to be at dinner with him on more than one occasion when he was telling us some fantastic stories, who's an amazing raconteur, fantastic. And so when the opportunity came along to come and work here, then yeah, it was something that I decided, well, if I don't, I'll regret it.
Yes, absolutely, forever.
So Andy very kindly spent 5 years teaching me the business and how to run it, and then after that period we sort of gradually switched over who was in charge, and so that was started that 12 years ago.
50 years, it's quite incredible. I mean, does it feel like it? I mean, you obviously haven't been here 50 years, but I mean,
you feel like 100 years.
Times it by nine is what
we usually say.
Yeah. And we had great fun. We had very good relationships with all our customers. We took looking after the customers seriously. And while we were here, we started to do race and rally backup and support. Mill & Melia particularly. We did a Mill & Melia when we were in Kentish Town, and we did another one when we were in Milton Keynes. But the Mill & Melia for us and the race and rally support really only took off in the mid-90s, at a time when the value of the cars started to rise, and you really couldn't do anything wrong if you were in the vintage car business. That was a golden decade. If not more. And we were very lucky, or I was very lucky, to be involved in the company at that time. There are always ups and downs. I bought the business in 1993 at the very bottom of quite a bad trough. It's not great at the moment, but it'll come back, you know. Kiri Batelli is here, fully stocked with good staff and a nice showroom, you know, to be here when it does all come back.
You said earlier you look after your customers, and you still do, but back in the early days, has the customer profile changed in the past 10 years?
I wouldn't know, really. I haven't been involved that much in customers.
Well, the use of the cars, maybe.
No, I've only been here sort of 12 years, but the use is fairly similar. So we have a small percentage who race, another slightly bigger percentage who rally, and the rest of them just use their cars sort of everyday Concours road use.
Well, that's what I was trying to get to, because I get the impression with some, unlike some other later Aston Martins, these pre-war cars are not garage queens. They do tend to be used, don't they?
No, and I think possibly in recent times, the best example, one of the customers who's here today, took his car from Toaster to, I think, somewhere in Croatia, went on holiday, then he drove to Athens and did a rally out of Athens, and then drove to Northern Italy and did another rally out of there, and then drove back. So he covered about 6,500 miles in around 5 or 6 weeks.
That's quite incredible, isn't it? So what's the rest of the year looking like for you, events-wise? You do a lot of events, don't you?
Yeah, so we are shortly going to send a team to Austria to support some cars on the Enstal Classic, which is about 1,000 kilometres around the Alps. Then we're running at Silverstone for the BRDC 500. We've got the Horsefall, with expecting a grid of about 20-25 cars. Which has been going, I think, 75 years or there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
And then the end of the season will be probably the revival. We've got three cars that we're taking, plus we're helping 10 Tenths look after them.
Well, the Trust will see you there, because the AMHT are at the revival as well this year, so yeah. That'd be good.
So another busy year. Yeah.
And Le Mans Classic next year?
Next year. Every other year.
Because it's going on this year as we speak, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah, that's the more modern course. Sort of 1970s onwards. And next year is the centenary of the Mille Miglia. So we're expecting a few cars to run on that.
Anything, Steve?
We're very lucky that through these two gentlemen's very hard work over the years has kept these amazing cars going. And I think, you know, not to be underestimated, the impact of the business on the survival rate of these very important cars, which is not far off 70%, which is incredible, really.
Yeah.
For cars that we can park almost in an order of when they were built.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be able to do that if it wasn't for Akira Batelli. So thank you to everybody that's been involved in running it, really.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for inviting us, and let you cracking on. You got a heavy box you want to put down.
Yes, chocolates for my wife.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Mike Stark to you. Mike lives in Aston Clinton and organised an event at Aston Hill last year to commemorate, well, I'll let him talk about that, but he's since then researched a lot of information about the history of motor racing at the village, and he's going to talk about that.
Thank you, Ali. Thank you. Well, firstly, good morning, everybody. As Ali said, my name is Mike Stark. I was the chair of the organising committee for the Aston Hill Centenary event that was held last year. And I know many of you came to it last May, so thank you for supporting our event. I'm also the co-author of the book, The Motorsport History of Aston Hill, which was published at the beginning of last year. After 3 years of researching the detailed history of motorsport that took place there. Firstly, I'd just like to start by saying a big thank you to Robert and Ali Blakemore for inviting me along today and for asking me to just do a short talk about Aston Hill as part of the Akiri Patelli 50th anniversary event. As you know, we are all here today to celebrate 50 wonderful years of Akiri Patelli. But as I'm sure you all know, the reason for Akiri Patelli's existence, i.e. pre-war Aston Martins, goes back well over 100 years. And there is a very steep hill on the eastern edge of Buckinghamshire called Aston Hill, which plays a very important part of the whole story. So for those of you who don't know, Aston Hill is in the parish of Aston Clinton. It was one of the country's leading motorsport venues during the very early pioneering years of motorsport in this country, either side of the First World War. And there was 30 major hill climbs that took place there between 1904 and 1925. Now, although 150 different car manufacturers competed at Aston Hill during that period, Aston Martin obviously has a unique relationship with Aston Hill, given the fact that it gave its name to the mark. I think I'm right in saying, and please, somebody more knowledgeable than me, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I'm right in saying that Aston Martin is the only make of car named after a motorsport venue. There are many models of car named after motorsport venues, such as Daytona, Sebring, Le Mans, Indianapolis, Silverstone, and so on, that have given their names to models of car, but I think I'm right in saying Aston Martin is the only one that's named after a motorsport venue, actually named after Aston Hill. And that obviously gives Aston Martin and Aston Hill a very close and unique relationship, which we've enjoyed and over 100 years and continues to this day. So what I'd like to do over the next literally 6 or 7 minutes is just talk through three key elements of that relationship for any of you who may not be aware of it. The first thing I want to talk about briefly is Lionel Martin and Robert Bamford when they actually first went to Aston Hill. The second thing is Aston Martin as a manufacturer competing at Aston Hill after the First World War. And then lastly, bring it up to more recent times and talk a little bit about the more recent relationship between Aston Hill and Aston Martin. So, for those of you who don't know, the 4th of April, 1914, is the key date in the history of Aston Martin, because that was the first time that Lionel Martin and Robert Bamford actually went to Aston Hill. And they competed in their Singer cars in an event organised by the Light Car Club. It was quite a unique event. It was a hill climb relay, where teams of four cars competed in a series of match races up the hill. Unfortunately, the team that was captained by Lionel Martin, which was made up of three Singers and a GWK, actually got knocked out in the first round by the team of Morgans that went on to win the event. Having said that, Lionel Martin got his revenge at the end of the day, because at the end of the event, there was a two-car match race between Lionel Martin and his Singer and Gordon McMinnies in a Morgan, who was the captain of the winning team. And although Gordon McMinnies took the lead, right off the start line and up round the first corner, Lionel Martin passed him and went on to win. So in fact, the only time that we're aware that two cars competed side by side up Aston Hill throughout its entire history, all the way up the course, the race was actually won by Lionel Martin the first time he was there. So there's a little bit of history for you. Then the following month was the annual open hill climb at Aston Hill. This was a very prestigious event. It was organised every year by the Hart County Auto and Aero Club. A very prestigious event with all the major manufacturers and drivers of the day competing. And in May 1914, although Robert Bamford didn't go there, Lionel Martin took his Singer back and actually won the 10 horsepower class on the formula and came second on time. And it was obviously following these two events that the decision was made to call the cars Aston Martin when they started manufacturing cars the following year when Coalscuttle was made. Then let's fast forward on to post-World War One. And post-World War One, the first time Aston Martin as a manufacturer competed at Aston Hill was in 1922 when Lionel Martin competed in AM270, a well-known Aston Martin, and actually achieved three class wins on formula. And what I mean by on formula is they took into account the time that the competitor took to get up the hill, but also used the method to take into account things like weight, power, number of passengers and so on to come up with a formula result. So Lionel Martin won the 10 horsepower class on formula at this event. And also a car, Aston Martin TT1, which I believe is the first ever racing Aston Martin made, better known nowadays as Green Pea, also competed there and came second in the 1500cc racing car class, only beaten by Raymond Mays's Bugatti. So that was the first time Aston Martin competed at Aston Hill in 1922. Then in 1923, Lionel Martin went back and won the 1500cc car class, both on formula and on time, again in AM270. And then there was two other Aston Martins competed. One was the well-known car that sadly no longer exists called Bunny. That was driven by Major Frank Halford, and that also won the 1500cc racing car class. And then another car that competed is actually here today, the Halford Special. It wasn't actually the Halford Special back then. It was driven by W.G. Barlow, and it was referred to as a standard sport Aston Martin back then, before it became the Halford Special, but that chassis competed at Aston Hill in 1923. And then the final event Aston Martin competed in Aston Hill was in 1924. Again, it was the annual open hill climb, and at that time there were four Aston Martins, and they achieved two class wins. Winifred Pink was driving AM270 and got a class win, and also Bunny, this time driven by E.R. Hall, also got a class win in the racing car class. So that's a brief synopsis of the history of Aston Martin at Aston Hill, and really why the relationship between the manufacturer and the hill is so important. Anybody who would like to know far more about it than I've just explained, please come and see me afterwards. I'll be over by the book stands over there, so please come and talk to me. I'd be very happy to talk to you. And finally, I'd just like to say, in terms of more recent times, for any of you who have not been to Aston Hill, firstly, shame on you, because you're not actually an Aston Martin enthusiast until you've been there. So please come and visit us at Aston Hill. If you've not been there, you won't have seen the Aston Martin monument that's at the top of the hill. That was unveiled in 1997 by John Martin, Lionel Martin's son, and by Lady Paula Brown, who was David Brown's widow at the time. So please come and visit us. You can see the monument. I can show you around the hill as well. And we've also, obviously, Ali mentioned the centenary event we had last year, but there's a number of other activities we now have between links between Aston Martin, Akiri Patelli, and the residents of Aston Cleanton to continue that wonderful relationship, including a few months ago when the Bamford and Martin cars actually came and spent a day at Aston Hill. So if you're interested to find out more, please come and talk to me, and I'll be delighted to share more information with you. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoy your day. And finally, just another big thank you to Robert, Ali, and everybody here at Akiri Patelli. Firstly, for a wonderful 50 years, and secondly, for inviting us all today to have a fabulous morning. So thank you very much, all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do go and have a chat with him later. It's very interesting. Next for you, I have two people. One is called Steve Waddingham, and he is Aston Martin's own in-house historian. He'll be doing his own talking bit later. But he's going to interview someone called Adam. Adam is the artist that you might have seen drawing away in there. He's also a Church of England curate, and he's also been a car designer in his life. So it'd be quite interesting to hear Steve interview Adam.
Thank you, Ali. Well, Adam, lovely to see you here. I think we've met here quite a few times over the years, but we first kind of got to know each other really at Aston Martin Lagonda at Gaydon. So tell us a little bit about how you first got involved with Aston Martin.
I'm very tempted to pick up a saxophone and try and have a go, but I think I'd probably ruin it. I've loved Aston's, I think probably like a lot of people here, since I was a little kid. Used to go to Newport Pagnell at every opportunity I could persuade my parents to drive me over there so I could see what was coming out of the service bay and see at the time the V8s on road test and stuff like that. And I've loved them ever since. And when they moved to Gaydon, I kind of followed, and I would go and have a look at all the cars coming off the production line. And I've always enjoyed drawing. I come from an artistic family. My parents used to take us on sketching days, and my dad would be drawing lots of pretty things like trees and flowers, and I'd be drawing the cars in the car park. And so I grew up loving Aston's, loving art, and putting them together. And I got the attention of Andy Palmer back in the Andy Palmer days, and he contacted me and said, look, we'd like you to be our artist for a year. Would you consider doing it? And I was like, yeah, of course I will. So I spent, that was 2018, and I spent a whole year as Aston's artist in residence. And that's just increased my love of both the history and the cars and the people. And I think for me, what's special about Aston Martin and special about here is that the cars come with their stories, but the people come with their stories too. And that's the bit I find just as interesting to listen to.
Absolutely. I've always said, it's all about the cars, but it's also about the people. And I know in America, one of our AMOC colleagues, a guy called Bob Welsh, came out with a classic statement once. He said, I came for the cars, but I stayed for the people. And I think that really nailed it on the head. And you and I, we did something a few years back, which was quite interesting. We went and celebrated the life of Count Louis Zabraski, who we discovered was buried in Melton Mowbray in a churchyard. And along with the owner of Green Pea, the famous car that Count Louis Zabraski funded and raced in the 1922 Strasbourg French Grand Prix, we actually went and spent a day painting the railings around the grave. Took a couple of chaps from Gaydon with us from the paint shop, and we spent a whole day wire brushing and re-handwriting the railings. And then with your help, Adam, we held a service of remembrance on the actual date, 100 years to the day of when he was killed, racing the Mercedes. But yeah, very much all about people. And all the cars that are here today, every car you can see will have a huge story to discover if you haven't already found out the story, if you own an old car, an old Aston. But we'll talk a little bit more about one of those projects later on. But going back to you, Adam, I should explain really to you, you should explain to the audience that you have a day job as well as being an artist, and it's quite an unusual kind of mix of the two careers.
Yeah, so I'm an ordained Church of England vicar. And I don't have a church as such. I run an organisation which seeks to kind of do community building with the car community, and particularly focus on mental health, mental welfare. And we work with a lot of people who maybe for no reason, no fault of their own, have struggled with their mental health. And we do projects like we've just finished restoring a Land Rover. And we've invited people to come and get involved, just because sometimes working on an old car can just actually be equally infuriating, but also equally therapeutic. And it's given people a space and a place to feel safe and to talk. And some people have come and they've had no experience of working on an old car at all, and they've just got their hands dirty and absolutely loved it. I think of two people who came and they spent the entire weekend just rubbing down body panels ready for spraying. And they were covered head to foot in dust and all sorts. And I was a bit worried about them, and I said, you know, are you okay? And they said, we've had the time of our life. It's just been absolutely brilliant. So we do a lot of stuff like that. We do a classic car pilgrimage every year. We take people across North Wales on a classic car pilgrimage. We've had a number of Astons do that, which is fantastic. It's always nice to have an Aston there. So I do that, and then I spend time drawing. I'm still involved a bit with Aston Martin in various ways. But the drawing and the stories and the history, that all gets wrapped up in my artwork. So if people can come and have a look at what I'm doing today, and they'll see that it's got text on it because it's about the story of each car. And people can order, we're doing a special Akiri Batelli 50th birthday piece of artwork, and people can come, and if they like it, they can order prints of it, and we will get prints done of it.
Yeah, let's give ourselves a bit of a plug. We're both in the workshop, so if you've not made your way in, do come and see us. Come and see Adam, come and see the artwork that he's producing live today. And if you want to, come and have a look at the book that I've written. I'm going to come back and talk a bit more about that a bit later. But yeah, I think we're both into restoration, aren't we? Car restoration and people restoration. So if any of that is of interest, come and talk to both of us. We'd love to talk to you. Thanks very much. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you very much.
I look for the bare necessities, the simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife.
Having a walk around here in the most magnificent display here at the Akiri Batelli. And who do I find in front of me with a big grin? Tom Wood, pre-war coordinator, AMOC. Is that right?
Yes, that is. Yes, thank you.
Let's introduce you with a big grin. You must be very happy here, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Hedgehog's back in her element here with all these cars. She's just over there by the Headlamp Special.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, yes, remember that car, yes.
It's owned by Julia Beldanza.
Right.
Not easy for me to say.
Well, I'll leave it with you to finish that off.
I've just been speaking to Will. Will was the chap who did all the work on him, or on her.
Yeah.
Was it 5 years ago now? Time flies.
5 years ago, has it been?
Done nearly 14,000 miles in her since then.
Oh, good grief.
I know.
Has she been okay?
Yeah, it's fine, yeah.
I knew you had a tyre problem, didn't you?
The wheels that had different sizes, so the back tyres kept on shredding the inner tubes when everything got too hot.
Yeah.
Because obviously it started to flex and they would catch the inner tubes.
Right.
So I've had four new wheels made at a vast expense, but touch wood, it's been fine ever since.
Looking at this display here, has anything here got you warm and excited?
That's a leading question.
Yeah, car wise,
I don't know.
They all look magnificent. Yeah.
The team cars are fantastic. I think they get, obviously they quite rightly get a lot of attention. But just looking here, there's a Mark II Blue 414. Stephen owns that. He's campaigns it. He races it as well. So it's stuff like that. It's sort of run of the mill Mark IIs, but in my mind, it's sitting next to Nigel Dowding's Mary Ancliffe's Mark II that's been rallied. They've done, I think, 54,000 miles in this car, and they're just going to South America. It's being shipped in a fortnight, and they're doing. I think they said it's a 28-day rally in that. Just amazing.
I was speaking to Robert Blakemore earlier, who was on about the customers, and people use these cars, don't they? They're not garage queens. He's done 14,000 in your car, and this one here. These cars do get used. They're not garage queens, are they?
No. Oh, definitely not. And they react to that. If you leave them, things start seizing up, the water pipes get bunged up. I use mine every week.
Yeah.
And it just starts on the nose. I never have to worry about battery charges or anything like that. It's used all year round. So.
It's a bit like the Truss Ulster. I think if you don't use that for a while and you go into it quite gently and you go off, it doesn't like being treated gently.
You have to
strangle the damn thing and then it's fine.
I still haven't driven the Truss Ulster.
Haven't you?
Nope, I need to. I need to come and have
That's
a go.
That's a shocking
I've driven A3. We did that photo shoot with one of my black, DB9 a while ago.
Okay. Good. All right, Tom. I've just seen someone. I'm going to grab him.
Cheers, Gary.
Thanks very much. John. Hello, John. You don't get away. You're smooging him past. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Gary.
Last time we get, like Tom, was in Austria.
It was indeed. What a weekend that was.
It was a cracking weekend, wasn't it? So what brings you here? statement of the obvious, I suppose.
Well, living not too far away.
No, do you?
I thought this was probably preferable than spending a lot of money on the Grand Prix.
I would just point out, this is John Godley.
Oh. Hello, everybody. I thought this was probably a more convivial gathering than hundreds of thousands at Silverstone, and sadly the green cars might not be at the front of the proceedings.
Yeah, that's another podcast for another story, isn't it? Yeah, I know, but it's plenty of lovely green cars here, isn't it?
Indeed so, yeah. It must be the biggest gathering, certainly the biggest gathering that I've seen.
I think you're right, you know, but speaking to Tom and Robert Blakemore earlier, these cars are used a lot, and you do tend to see them sort of on events, and they all seem to cluster together.
Yeah, you do see some more racing than used to be at the VSCC events. But, you know, going back, you know, you and I know 30-odd years ago, the Horsfall race had 30-plus cars each year. And the Halford Special is starting off, by the looks of things.
Yeah, it is, actually.
But in the days of, you know, Judy Hogg and Andy Bell, they had gatherings like this, but they were much more low-key. But that was probably the last time I came here to see more than, let's say, a dozen cars. So it's a great day.
And what a great smell from that Halford Special.
Oh, that's proper fuel.
That's proper fuel. You don't get that from a lithium battery, do you?
No, exactly. There's no burning smell. It's just good juice.
All right, John, lovely to see you.
Good to see you, Gary.
And I'll probably see you in a few months' time, and I shall abuse you of a microphone
that's
yet again.
Some other big event. Look forward to it.
All right, take care.
Cheers.
As Ali just mentioned, I worked directly for Aston Martin Lagonda as the company historian, so that's my day job. I'm also a trustee of the Aston Martin Heritage Trust, so that also keeps me very, very busy between the two roles. And one thing I've never done until a couple of years ago was write a book, something I'd always wanted to do, and I know they say everybody's got a good book inside them. But this all came about really as a bit of a personal challenge. The people who now own the car known as LM4, which is the lovely green, bright green car on the end here, which is behind Fred and Ali, the people that now own the car came to me for advice, really. They'd found out the car was for sale. I'd met Jonathan, the now owner of the car, at Goodwood in 2021. And we spent a few minutes looking at LM7. So it's quite apt that LM7 is marked next to LM4. And we were looking at the car, and I was telling him a little bit about the history of the car and about some of the exploits of the owners of LM7. And little did I know that actually then kind of influenced Jonathan to go back home and sort of sit and think about the idea of owning an old Aston Martin. He'd already got quite a few modern Aston Martins and a couple of classic ones, but he'd never, ever even sat in a pre-war car before at that point. And he did some research, and he did that thing that many of us do, spent far too long on the internet looking at things, stumbled across LM4, and then, of course, reached for the AMOC register to look up the history. And in the register was only really a couple of lines of history. So he phoned me up and he said, look, you know, it's a 90-year-old car. Do you think this car would have any more history to find? And I kind of rather nervously tucked the phone under my chin and grabbed the register off my desk and reminded myself of the history and looked at it and thought, well, there must be. You know, it's a 90-year-old car. There's got to be more to find than just what's in the register. And he said to me, let me give you a little bit of a challenge. If you'll research the car and write a book about it, I'll buy the car. And at that point, the sort of gauntlet was laid down. And I said, well, it's just two conditions, really. First of all, I need to make sure AML are happy for me to go ahead and do this. You're a current modern day car customer, so hopefully that should be okay. But I need to ask them. And the other condition is I don't want to get paid. I want to be able to do this at my own sort of pace and purely for fun. So we kind of agreed over the phone that providing those two things could be agreed on, that would all be okay. And the next thing you know, I found myself starting to research the contents of the car's history to try and make a book from it. And in order to do that, my great friend Martin Soule, is just stood over waving at you now in the black t-shirt. Martin is an amazing genealogist, and he and I have kind of worked on a few pre-war projects before. So I said to Martin, well, we've got a really big project and this is going to be a really difficult one because there isn't a lot of history for this car. So thankfully, we struck gold. I went to see Bruce Young, who's another amazing character in the world of Aston Martin. Bruce and his then father, Jim, managed to talk me through what information they had on the car. So the original service and build records from the factory. And that was really our starting point. And we were very, very lucky that we managed to translate who the owners of the car had been over the years with the help of that and also the records from the owners club. So it kind of gave us a list of people to go after. And incredibly, although the car's 90 years old or now 96 years old, the car had only had about 7 owners. So not that many people over a long period of time. And we started digging, Martin started digging. And what we discovered was an amazing tale, really. As we said earlier today, that these cars, it's all about the people who've owned the cars. The people who own these cars quite often shape them. And when you get into it, you find, in the case of LM4, people that were racing drivers, people that then found themselves in the conflicts of World War II and having to survive that. Some of them flying aeroplanes into combat. I even discovered a relative. So one of my relatives flew in the same squadron alongside the owner of LM4. So it's an amazing tale, really. And then through to the sort of owner that owned the car for the longest amount of time, bought the car in 1951, and he owned it way into the 1990s, sold it in about 1996. So that took the car through all that kind of years of sitting around with the paint flaking off it. The car was restored in the 90s. And then it had this new lease of life again through being sold through Acura Bertelli back in 2021. A bit of a fairy tale that the car then went with the novice owner driver. So Jonathan never even sat in a pre-war car before. He learnt to race. He learned to drive the car. He signed up with Darren Turner, who's a well-known Aston Martin racing driver himself, won Le Mans 3 times. And Darren agreed to race the car alongside Jonathan, providing the car was going to be fast enough to not be at the back of the grid all the time. So the car had quite a lot of work done to it here at Acura Bertelli. And it ended up going to the Le Mans Classic in 2023. And they actually came first in their plateau. So pretty amazing. And within 18 months of buying the car, this guy had never sat in one before, was, you know, there crossing the line at Le Mans, living the dream, as they say. So quite an amazing tale, bang up to date. In terms of Aston Martin and pre-war Aston Martins, I think it's really a point now to say that we're very, very lucky to have companies like Acura Bertelli and people like Bruce Young that have supported these cars over the years. And we're so lucky that so many of them survive. It's quite incredible, really. Aston Martin only built just under 700 cars leading up to 1940. And around about 70% of those survive today. And that's a lot of that is down to the expertise that's been available right the way through from those sort of just after the war days right through to now. And also the passion of the owners, the people have quite often owned these cars for many decades, and you guys that own them now. So thank you very much for doing that. It gives Aston Martin itself something to talk about. We're very lucky to have a history that we have and to have a bunch of people around the world that own the cars and keep supporting Aston Martin. So thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for listening. Hope to meet some of you today. Thank you.
Discover more about the story of Aston Martin, the cars, the people, the history with the Aston Martin Heritage Trust. You're always welcome to visit us at our museum in Oxfordshire. So find out more via amht.org.uk.